Down by the river,
down by the river,
we took a little walk,
we took a little walk.
I'm gonna tell you a story.
Dirty Water Sports presents the Down by the River podcast with your hosts Tim DeLacio and Paul Testa.
Let's go Red Sox!
Hello and welcome to episode number 6 of Down by the River, a weekly podcast from the folks at Dirty Water Sports. I'm Tim DeLacio. He's Paul Testa. And Paul, quick turnaround since our last show because things are happening around Red Sox Nation. Big controversial night last night down in the Bronx.
Crazy how that ended. I mean, the thing that has me upset about the entire thing is, I mean, that's what you want as a baseball fan. That's what you want even as a Yankees fan, Red Sox, Yankees. You want David Ortiz up with the bases loaded with a chance to win the game or end the game. Or, you know, he could have easily have grounded into a double play and ended the game. What was upsetting about it was, you know, the bat was taken out of his hands. He clearly got, in my opinion, ball four twice. It definitely on the 3-2 pitch. People are arguing that, the 3-1 pitch did cross and it was crossed up and it just looked really bad. I don't necessarily buy it. And I also say when a catcher's crossed up like that, 99 out of 100 times, it's going to be called a ball just for that simple reason, even if it is a strike.
Well, and Culpa said, if we go back, break down, Culpa said on the 3-1 pitch that he had it in the zone, you know, crossing through the zone. McCann didn't help me out very much, right?
Right. Well,
I actually give him credit for calling that pitch a strike if he had it in the zone and the catcher didn't frame it properly, right? Like, and I also think on the TV view, Andrew Miller comes from so far on the left side and that ball breaks so much, and it continues breaking after it crosses the plate.
Right.
Because, I mean, it's just that frisbee slider that keeps moving. I don't think we, as fans on TV, have a great view of where that ball crosses the zone, where that ball is when it crosses the zone, right? Because not many pitchers have that much movement continuing past the plate. I think that's, Andrew Miller has one of the best sliders in baseball, and I think that's part of it. So I'll give him that. Maybe the 3-1 pitch was borderline, could have gone either way. And I'll also say, and I think this is definitely on David a little bit, he overreacted. He demonstratively yelled at Ron Culpa multiple times. Now, did he say anything over the line? I don't think so. It seemed like he said no a lot.
He said no, no, no.
Right. But he did say it pretty forcefully.
Sure.
And he could have said it the first time and then backed off, right? He could have gathered himself, but he kind of probed just a little bit past comfort.
All around. So I think it was a boiling point. Did he overreact? Yes. And no one's ever going to say, like, I'll never say, like, no, he had every right to do that. He overreacted.
Right.
Was he forced into that overreaction? I would say maybe.
There were calls that whole game. Culpa's strike zone was bad, most of the game. Now, I, from a Red Sox point of view, I don't know, was it equally as inconsistent or wide or bad, however you want to describe it, from the other side of the plate, from the Yankees side? I don't know. I didn't notice it that way. It seemed more one-sided.
Yeah, I mean, it was bad both ways. I mean, equal amount, I don't know. But he didn't have a good night at
right.
all.
Okay, so now let's move to the 3-2 pitch. I think we can all establish that ball was low.
Right.
And even if you have that ball in the zone, right, it was low enough that, 99 times that pitch is thrown out of 100, that's going to be called a ball by Ron Culpa. It's not that he has a low strike zone. It's that he clearly decided ahead of time, Or maybe he didn't decide. He reacted to the situation and called that ball a strike because he felt like David Ortiz had shown him up.
Sure. Yeah, there's no doubt that happened. I mean,
So that's, to me, the frustration is not so much the call. If that call gets made, let's say Ortiz on the 3-1 pitch swings and misses. 3-2 pitch comes, and it's that pitch and that call. Are you as upset as you are now?
No, because I felt like David Ortiz earned a walk twice.
Yeah.
Right. I understand everything that you're saying, and you know, Alex Speer today on Nesson did a great job with the, you know, the Speer and not Speer, that's his last name, the Prism, with the Quest Tech. That was quite the explanation. But yeah, I understand that it may have caught in the zone. I'm just saying Culpa is not that good to have the eyes to be able to say, that was in the zone there, but it was, you know, it ended up, let's be honest, at least 8 inches outside and down.
Yeah.
Right?
I think you have to remember, though, that if you look at the way it was going, I mean, McCann certainly, he took it away, and also, like I said, if we had an overhead view straight down the line,
yeah,
I think you would see that ball on the plate.
It did. They gave that view.
Did you? I didn't see
an overhead view. Well, I was watching MLB Network.
Okay.
We'll get into that and maybe a future show on why I've chosen to listen to others. But I was watching MLB Network, and they had over. It caught the outside part of the plate. It did, right on the edge.
Yeah.
It looked like it was very low. It looked like it was the same exact thing. Like, it was in the zone, but it was low. It was a low pitch, below the knees.
That's it. So, yeah, and I saw that one as at the knees and, if anything, outside, right? It, because of the way McCann framed it. I thought the other one was a good 6 inches lower than the 3-2 pitch was a good 6 inches lower than the first one. But as you can see, like, we're having different interpretations of the same pitches. But the one thing that no one is having outside of Ron Culpa different interpretations of is the 3-2 pitch. So this is where, the umpire, in my opinion, put himself into the result.
The game. Yeah, exactly.
And that's the one thing you can't do, especially in that situation. And look, tie game, bases still loaded, one out, Hanley coming up.
All you need is a fly ball.
Let's give the Red Sox like a 75% chance of winning that game if that call doesn't get made. Is that fair?
Yeah. Do they have a 75%?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
With Hanley coming up, base has loaded, one out, and all you need is a fly ball. And
you go into the fight. If it goes into extras, Betances and Miller are already burned, and the Red Sox haven't touched anyone in their bullpen of note. Right, so
right.
I mean, you definitely there's probably more like a 90% chance that if that game's tied after that walk, the Red Sox go on to win it. We're in a season where we all think they're going to be fighting tooth and nail for either, you know, maybe the division if they're lucky, but that, you know, in that first or second wild card race, when we look back on it, one game could very well be the difference between a successful season and a slight disappointment. And you know, I think the stakes are high.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair statement, and if we are eliminated by one game, you know, we'll all come back to this game. Well, I'm pretty certain somewhere along the lines, you know, the baseball gods will make this up to us somehow, and we'll steal a game somehow.
Fair point. Long season marathon, not a sprint, but, Paul.
Right. So I think we'd have to keep track of that to know for certain. But your natural instinct would always be to come back to this game. And I think everyone has the right to feel robbed about that game. The Twitter reaction was incredible.
Unanimous and instant.
Yeah, it was fun. It was to read and follow. And I I was actually it's the first time in a long time that you kind of felt like there was a lot of people, like a lot of people are with this team versus,
yes,
you know, oh crap, you know, we can't handle a bullpen, or, you know, when are we suck this and that. Why is Chris Young up there? You know, it wasn't that. It was like a uniformed, like, you're messing with our team, and I don't like that. It was nice to see.
Definitely. I mean, this team wins 2 out of 3 in Chicago, and, you know, people have jumped on the bandwagon, you know, for certain, and for good reason. I mean, and
Chicago could have went horrible, right? I mean, you lose the first game. You got Buckles that gives up a 2-run home run in the first inning of the start of the second game. And you're like, here we go.
Yep.
Yeah, sure. We can beat up on Houston. We can beat up on the crappy Yankees. And I forgot who else. There was another bad team that came in.
Atlanta. Easy to forget.
Yeah. You know, we can beat up on them. But as soon as we play a good team, and then we go, you know, Buckles, very good game. Followed up the following night with a win. You're going into New York. You're feeling confident, and you were kind of robbed. So, and it was like, no, you killed our momentum. We were pissed.
That's what it felt like. And yeah, look, the Red Sox did their fair share of momentum killing that game, and they had tremendous opportunities throughout the game. And at one point, I tweeted last night. Is it just me? Does it seem like this team isn't getting their fair share of runs when they've had the bases loaded this year? Right?
Oh yeah, okay. It's horrible. And untimely double plays. Hicks misplays two balls back to back to center. And I'm not even gonna hop on Hanley about that. Like I was fooled by it. Like from watching it. Like I was like he's gonna make this play. And
you can't be too aggressive on that. I mean, you know, going first to third after you read the balls, you know, dropping in. It would have been questionable to think that he could have gone first to third, and then the next one was even, you know, more station to station.
What if he reads it right? I mean, he catches it. You know, like there's really not much you can do. And if balls are bouncing in front of him, he's coming in, you can't get too far off second base. You can't get too far off first base on the first one, because if he's running and catching it in, he's just, you know, his momentum can double you up. So it was like two misplays like that. Boring, which one run should have at least in that situation. No? You lose me?
I did lose you for a second there, Paul.
I have no. I was saying one run should have scored.
Yes.
You know, but two misplays by an outfielder freezing the runners in that thing, they end up bases loaded and then double play, and you're out of the inning.
I looked up yesterday, and this was during the game yesterday, so there were three bases loaded at-bats yesterday that were two strikeouts and the double play by Jackie Bradley Jr., so I'm sure these numbers came down even more. But the Red Sox this year are 4-for-25, so that'd be now 4-for-28 with the bases loaded. A batting average on balls in play of under 100 now. Coming into the game, they only had 3 strikeouts, right? So every time they've had the bases loaded, they've been putting the ball in play and getting very little results out of it. Mm-hmm. As far as keeping those, you know, the line moving with base hits. In almost every other situation at bat-wise, when you look at the Baseball Reference splits by, on-base runner situation, the Red Sox are hitting the ball well. All the numbers that you would expect. Batting average on balls in play is pretty consistent. This is the one glaring, you know, weakness, I guess, or piece of misfortune for this team. I think those numbers, you know, even out over the course of the year, but really there's nothing more frustrating as a fan than you get the bases loaded and you go, oh, here we go again.
Here we go again. What was worse is the double plays. I mean, that shouldn't happen with the bases loaded.
They've grounded it.
That's what's just...
4 bases loaded double plays this year, including yesterday's. So, yeah, I think if you look at the way this team offensively has been going, more often than not, they've plated runners when they've had the opportunity, right? The offense has had a couple games like last night where the opportunities just didn't come through. Let's say 4 out of every 5 games, the offense does their job. More concerning, maybe, in this series, we go to today, Paul. After last night, you were really looking for David Price to come out and have this be a statement game, right?
Yeah. I mean, this lineup is just gross, too, that the Yankees are putting out there. There's no one in it. It's just... We talked before the show started, and you were like, yeah, I don't know. I'm officially worried. I'm officially, like I said, this guy stinks. And I don't know if he necessarily stinks, or I think I'm going more along the lines of the things that you've talked about before and the velocity and all that stuff. I think there's something not right with him.
His velocity's down. I heard someone saying, maybe it was Alex Speer. I can't remember. Maybe it was O'Brien. Someone you clearly didn't hear because you're not listening to the broadcast, Paul, saying that traditionally Price's April velocity numbers are a little bit lower, and that comes – he builds on that throughout the course of the season. I haven't validated those numbers and seen them, but, even if we go with that, it seems like he's just not able right now to shut the door, right? Like he can get 2 strikes at the key situations. He can get to 2 outs to get out of jams. It's just that last batter, that last pitch that seems to get him into trouble. I think today it clearly looked like he missed his spots both to Gregorius with the bases loaded to give up that triple. Got way too much of the plate and left it a little too high with 2 strikes. And then the same with Beltran. He just got way too much of the plate with a 1-2 count. And, is in both those situations, if he has another 2 miles an hour on that velocity and throwing 95, does he have to be so fine with those, with those pitches? Or is he just throwing some high gas?
Yeah, I mean you're right though. He does. He gets 2 strikes of the best of them, and he hasn't been able to put them away. And there's also a lot of, long at bats against him. A lot of fall offs. It's also not April anymore, so we're into May.
True.
But that being said, I was listening to the broadcast today, and it was. O'Brien brought it up to Lyons is like, well, where is it? When can we expect it? And, Lyons with his great analysis said, I don't know. It's obviously something that everyone's noticing, right? The velocity's down. Everyone's expecting it to come back. But the question's still being asked. When are we going to get it? Like, we're not getting that answer. We're not hearing that from David Price. Like, well, traditionally this takes, and I'll be up at not a number. I'll be at 95, but like I just have to get into it a little bit more, feel a little bit more comfortable. Or I'd almost rather hear like my shoulder's a little fatigued, or I want to get checked out. I almost want him to get checked out. I want to know he's healthy, and not out there and we're looking at a year long surgery.
Yeah, that would really be a kick in the balls.
Which clearly we didn't insure his contract, most likely.
No, so. we're not in favor of insuring for shoulders, Paul. Some interesting things. If you look at fielding independent pitching as a barometer for when compared to ERA, now I understand fielding independent pitching, FIP as it's called, is a measure of the things supposedly a pitcher can control. Walks, home runs, strikeouts, kind of takes the variability of balls that are hit in play, out of the situation. I don't look at it as an absolute number, but when there's a great differential between a pitcher's fielding independent pitching and their true ERA, that's where I say, okay, there's been, this is not going to continue this way. David Price has a FIP under 3, an ERA over 7. You know, clearly he's given up hits in bad situations, clustered together. You know, his batting average on balls in play is I don't know what it is.
It was over 400.
Yeah, but it's still high or higher than, you know, it will be at the end of the year. And I think that bad luck, like I said, you know, to you before the show, that bad luck has been compounded by, you know, him not, you know, not pitching as well as we expected at the same time, right? So it's, I think there's some process problems with Price pitching, and then there's some pure results problems, right? That were, even if he was pitching well, you know, the batting average of balls in play, for example, is gonna bite you a little bit. Do I think he'll get better? Yes. I don't think he'll end up with a 7.5 ERA at the end of the year. Does it concern me that when he gives up 3 runs, Paul, he tends to give up 6?
Right.
That's starting to become a little bit of a problem. It's almost like he puts the pressure on himself to be great, and if he's not great, then the wheels start to fall off a little bit too much. That would be that's definitely a concern, in my opinion.
Yeah, that is where it's worrisome.
At the same time, let's kind of turn it over. Another person that I've asked you a lot about this year is Mookie Betts, Paul. And every year, every week, you say, no, don't worry yet.
Not worried. Still not worried about it.
Not worried.
Nope.
You know, we got to the point last night where he was bunted in a key situation on his own accord. Does that not start to speak to confidence a little bit, Paul?
Definitely.
And once confidence, I mean, isn't this the same? I mean, aren't we saying similar things with Price and with Mookie Betts here?
No.
I mean, I understand it's a pitcher and a hitter, and also we know the pitcher's velocity. Like, we have some measurables about the pitcher that say he's not able to do the same things that made him successful, right? So maybe that's the key difference.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to say to me, Mookie Betts' bat speed is 10% slower right now than it was last year, then maybe it's more similar. But I guess the physical intangibles don't seem any different, right?
Tim, I'm sorry. I'm having a little bit of a technical issue.
Uh-oh.
All right. Could you say that again? I'm sorry. I had something in my ear.
There you go. All right. So, no, I said if with Price, we have a measurable, right? Mm-hmm. Fastball, you know, velocity is down.
Right.
With Betts, we don't have a measurable that we can say is worse than it was at some other time. So, bat speed isn't 10% slower than it was last year. It's just, you know, we don't have any indication that the process of what he's doing is wrong. It's just the results aren't there. With Price, we have some suspicion that it's both the process and the results that are of issue.
Right. And so, I mean, well, Mookie's not delivering results. I get it. And specifically trying to bunt last night in a key situation on his own, that was kind of a little bit alarming, or maybe someone that didn't believe in himself as much. But I just bring you back to, like, the first at bat today. You know, he's getting pitched inside, jammed on the hands, and, you know, fights it up the middle for a base hit. Like, he's still got, like, that takes a lot of strength and a lot of bat speed to be able to do that for where he hit the ball on the bat. And he's just got to get to a point where he ends up squaring up the ball at the right point and driving the thing. He's had a lot of hard hits that were caught. He's striking out a little bit too much. I mean, that's kind of alarming, but overall, I'm not worried about Mookie Betts. I think he's going to come more towards, like, what Jackie Bradley Jr. has done over the last 10 games or so, I'm worried that Jackie Bradley Jr. is not going to be able to maintain what he's doing, and we're going to go through another regression. I'm more worried about that than I am Mookie not getting hot. And, you know, it's only going to take a week or two of his hot streak before you know it, where he's sitting at like 295, you know.
Well, and that's true. We know the one thing we have seen in a short time so far in the majors is that when he gets hot, he gets hot. It's like Pedroia often, right? Like when just goes on a tear, and, you know, once he gets hot, he tends to stay hot. So I think that's absolutely a fair point.
Then again, right down the line, we don't need him right now. I mean, we'd love to have him.
Yep.
Overall, we don't need him. You know, you just mentioned Pedroia. He's playing unbelievable. Big Poppy in his farewell season. I mean, this is crazy what he's doing.
Yep.
Even Hanley, who's not, like, producing at the offensive level that you would like, isn't hurting the team because he is hitting the ball to the opposite field. He did hit a couple home runs in Chicago this week. He might be getting on, but I mean, he was still as bad as he was from driving the ball standby minus the first week of the season. He was still batting what, 280?
Yeah, and now he's out there like 2-for-3 last night. He's up at 290 something before the last of 2-for-4 last night. I mean, I think, you know,
Travis Shaw's played unbelievable. I mean, so you don't need Mookie. You're going to need him, but right now you don't need him.
Right. No, and I think
you need David Price now.
Yeah, I think if you were to tell me, if you were to give me one player that you don't have to worry about and I would feel the best about, it'd be David Price, right? If you were to say, don't worry about the rest, like you only one player, or no, say one player is going to right themselves at some point this year and kind of be who we expect them to be, and that player is going to be Price, I'd say I'll take it, and the rest will all fall into place.
Right.
So I think looking forward past this Yankee series, and, you know, I mean, I don't know that there's a comeback, you know, left in today's game. We'll see. They've done it all year, and we know that the Yankee bullpen does not have Betances or Miller this afternoon available to them. So, you know, fingers crossed. But if today's comeback isn't in the cards, tomorrow's game is important in that you hate to get that 3-game losing streak or swept by this team specifically in Yankee Stadium. But, Paul, they come home. I believe they have 13 of their next 16 games at home.
Yes, I saw that schedule came up, and the schedule doesn't look that difficult.
So once again, we've talked about the schedule being, it was difficult in the beginning of the year, and then it started to be beneficial towards them. We hit another stretch here where, look, if they had kept the momentum through Chicago, won last night, and then this were a blip in the radar, and they get 2 out of 3 in New York, and then they go on to this 13 out of 16 at home, you'd feel really good about, you know, where this team's at. It's amazing how a bad Price start against a bad Yankee team at Yankee Stadium kind of deflates the momentum and confidence a little bit and colors the mood around this team. But
when we kicked off the show, I talked about kind of how, like, watching the game last night, I was pissed. The reason why I was pissed was because I just felt like I was robbed of a dramatic moment one way or the other. But I didn't feel like, oh, crap, we got robbed, or, you know, like, I wasn't like that. But because I kind of felt like, okay, well, we got Price going tomorrow. You know, we're still going to take 2 or 3 out of 3, and that's all you really want anyways. It's no big deal.
Yep.
This game today, you know, should we not pull it out? You're right. I mean, that makes Friday a little bit,
quite frankly, annoys me more
right.
than last night's. Because
it should be a win.
One should be a win. There's no reason, and especially when you stake your number one starter a lead,
mm-hmm.
like in this is a game where he should shut that down. You're going against Evaldi, who is, I believe he was what, 1-4.
Yeah,
I mean, good pitcher, but still, like, you know, you could have put the pressure on early and gotten inside the youngster's head and ridden your ace to a 2-1. 4-1, you know, type win, and you know, that's what I expect out of David Price. We'll see. I mean, we won't make the whole show about David Price, but that's definitely a, you know, a glaring problem. Now, look, quickly, we glossed over Clay Buchholz,
mm-hmm.
and Rick Porcello. We'll go down the line. Buchholz, encouraging start, especially after that first inning when you have just no confidence in his mental ability to get through stuff.
Right.
Did. Do we have any confidence the next time he hits the mound that this is going to be a trend, or even we'll get a mediocre, average Clay Buchholz? I don't know.
Well, that's the thing, though, Tim. I don't believe there is a mediocre Clay
Buchholz. He's either brilliant or horrible. one or the other.
Which ends up with a mediocre stat line, or, you know, when you look at it over the course of a whole season. But, I mean, you had that 1 year of brilliance, which he didn't even pitch a full year because he got injured. So you had last year, which started off very similar to this, but he kind of ended with a
– He had a good run at the end of the year.
But then got hurt again. I mean, I think he had a 3.26 ERA last year. Like, he was good. He's good or he's terrible. That's it. And he's terrible a lot more times than he's good, but when he's good, he's – really, really good.
Yeah, like, well, that's true.
Like, so, unhittable good.
So, and we'll see. We'll see if what happens with Buchholz, but we can't count on anything, right? Stephen Wright and Rick Porcello, neither one of them necessarily had their best stuff at the start of their games.
Right.
Both of them ended up with encouraging stat lines, right, and performances.
I mean, anything you get in from Stephen Wright is just great. I mean, it's so great.
But do you slot
him
into the Wakefield situation where now he's just like, he's going to lose some, but, you know, he's going to win some, and he's going to give you innings, and so he's in there for the long haul.
I think so. I don't know how you take him out right now.
Yeah.
You don't really have to face that decision until Kelly comes back, but. Yeah, I don't know how you take him out. So, which kind of like lends to a little bit what you saw from Buchholz in Chicago is because it was getting to the point where it was almost easy to cut bait with.
He was pitching for his life, right?
Yeah.
A little bit, especially with the timing of the John Danks release in Chicago, just ahead of that game, right? Because they looked like identical pitchers on the stat line.
Right.
And they've been, you know, contracts very similar last year of their contract. So it was like almost a mirror image of Clay Buchholz over there. Got cut bait. But John Danks doesn't have quite the tantalizing ceiling that Clay Buchholz does, which was his saving grace. And then he came out with a John Farrell, to his credit, kind of called him out on the mat a little bit. And he kind of came through. So,
And then you have Porcello, which, I mean, what am I going to do? Like, I do care that he went out there for the seventh inning and gave up a home run? I mean, I said if you can give me six innings, three runs every single time out, to me that was the $22 million Rick Porcello. What he's given so far this year and what he looks like he can continuously repeat and has learned where he flawed last year and how he can make it better, like, no, I don't. I mean, because he's 5-1 now and gave up a home run in the seventh. I'll take what he's given every. I mean, he's been our best pitcher so far.
Absolutely, and you know, he didn't. I don't think that he had his best stuff. Yesterday at
all.
No,
it was a dreary night. I mean, tough to get loose. But overall, I mean, yeah, he didn't have his best stuff and pitched seven innings and gave up three runs. Like, what else do I want?
That's what you're looking for from anyone, let alone Rick Porcello. Paul, so talking about the starting pitching, one thing I did want to touch on, obviously the news was out there that Tim Lincecum, throwing off the mound for scouts. Red Sox obviously there among, every team was there, so that's not news. If you're the Red Sox right now and you see something in Lincecum, are you taking a flyer there?
Well, I mean, Tim, I guess I would just throw that question right back at you, and it's like, where does he fit?
Like, well, he seems like you've got a lot of that, right?
I mean,
he is potentially Clay Buchholz, Joe Kelly, Henry Owens, all wrapped up into one.
Now, if you tell me that you're willing to try and trade Buchholz, right?
You're willing to move Joe Kelly to the pen.
You're willing to move Joe Kelly to the pen. Do I want Tim Lincecum and have him be that flyer? The answer is yes. Until I have answers to those questions, I don't want. I mean, all it is like, well, there's no room for him. There's nothing you can really do. I mean, I guess as you go down on rehab assignments and you wait it out, right? I mean,
that's what they could be looking at. You know, all right, insurance policy against the Buchholz injury, you know, Eduardo Rodriguez, we don't exactly, he'll be back soon, but with that, you know, we don't exactly know, if that injury will flare again. So we've got just enough questions that if he's going to take, and I feel like there was a pitcher that we did this with a couple years ago, and I don't remember who it is off the top of my head, that we picked up who was injured and he was going to rehab, and then maybe he would be an impact in the second half of the season, and it ended up not working, but I can't remember who it was. But you know, I could see taking the flyer if it's a one-year deal, it's just money. Like, and
yeah, I mean, I guess,
but you can't guarantee him the spot. That's the key. Is like he's an insurance policy in the,
right.
You know, and he's gonna go to the he's gonna work rehab in the minors, and you know.
But isn't he gonna get that guaranteed spot somewhere else? Like, I mean, that's the thing.
I would think so,
right?
And that's where why would you come to Boston if you're Tim Lincecum,
right?
And who knows? Maybe he pitched someone gives him 2 years.
Right.
And it's not just this year, right? And so then, you know, it's a whole separate conversation. But I think it's, you know, it was interesting timing. You know, I think it would almost benefit the Red Sox more if this show from Tim Lincecum happened in 3 or 4 weeks, when there's a little bit more certainty. Right now, there's enough uncertainty that you're kind of like, well, maybe we should be considering this. In 3 or 4 weeks, you might certainly know you should or certainly know you should not be considering it.
Well, think about that. With the logjam that we have, or the potential logjam that we have, let's say Buchholz puts it together for 2 more starts in a row. Would you trade him? Or would you, knowing that an injury or bad Clay is probably going to show his...
If I had interest in Clay Buchholz, I guess at this point it'd be what am I getting back, right? Like I would need to get something that was of value to me, not necessarily this year. I would trade him for assets that are valuable for future years. You know, if you were to say, you know, like, is there, if you were to give me a lefty reliever that could complement Ross and be better than Tommy Lane,
mm-hmm.
right? That could be, you know, that's someone that really settles in there. That could be a spot where, you know, it could be nice to have. But I'm not just going to give up on him because, you know, unless you say, well, let's give up on him, get something, and bring in Lincecum, and it's basically
like
a wash.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, maybe you bring in Lincecum.
Yeah, it would totally depend on what you...
On a 2 years contract. Maybe that's your offer.
It would depend on what it is. You know, and I guess the other
thing... That's played 20 this year, right? Like, is it worth taking a flyer, you know, for $24 million over 2 years versus 1 year of Clay at 12?
That's a good. I mean, where that becomes a really good question, Paul, is if you don't have confidence in Henry Owens or Brian Johnson, for example.
I have zero confidence in Henry.
Being something substantial.
Why do we build? Brian Johnson, I'm not down on by any stretch of the imagination yet. But when's the last time one of these guys? I mean, it's Rodriguez, right? That he's come up and even.
But remember, he came up 6 months after you acquired him.
Right. Yeah.
He wasn't even a homegrown prospect. You know, I think we've seen pitchers dominate in the lower levels, but have we really seen many pitchers dominate up into the Triple A? You know, like where was the last dominant Triple A pitcher that's come into the rotation? And that's where if I go back, I think Lester, Buchholz, those guys came up through Pawtucket. I know Buchholz did.
No, I think they came up through Portland.
Did they come straight from Portland?
I thought I remembered them
in Triple A, but I don't know. You look at Anderson Espinosa, right? They just had a big prospect, struggled early this season, and then he just threw up, you know, 5 innings, 11 Ks,
right.
Yeah, you know, down in, what is he, single A or double A?
Single A. He's in Greenville, okay. I think. Well, whichever, the other two are in Salem or Greenville.
Yeah.
He's at the other one.
So you look at that and you think, I remember when Henry Owens was pitching 60 consecutive no-hit innings or whatever.
Right.
You know, like, and And then you don't see it. But with Henry Owens, you wonder, was his control better then? Or is it something about major league hitting that is making him lose his control because he doesn't have overpowering stuff, right? But
I'll tell you, Tim, it's something that is frustrating and it won't play. I mean, you're not going to be a successful major league pitcher unless you can throw strikes.
But remember, I mean, Andrew Miller, the tall, lanky lefty, went through the same thing with wildness. Now his
tall, lanky lefty that could throw 98.
That's the big difference. Is Owens doesn't have the fastball, but then again, you know, Miller doesn't necessarily have the curve or the changeup that Owens had. So they're you've seen these taller pitchers, right? There's more can go wrong in their windups. Right. There's more variability there. I don't know if he can find it, but I'm not going to. I'm not necessarily going to count on him as one of the five next year. So back to your point about Lincecum, if you think he can be an insurance policy toward the end of this year in the second half, and he might be one of your five next year because Clay's definitely gone.
Right.
Okay. Now, Joe
Kelly, might be. Now you're 100% you solidify the ball. Yeah. I guess, I mean, I don't know. To me, I would rather take chances. If we know people are not going to be here next year, and we're not certain that they're going to help us this year, why not try and get something else?
Get something else. Now that I agree with. And the problem with Lincecum is he's a year off of surgery.
Yeah,
and so you'd rather go with the unknown that you know than the unknown that you don't have any idea about, right?
Maybe that's what you would like. I would like to go the other way. I'd rather. I mean, if I'm gonna watch someone give up, five runs in three innings,
you'd rather it be Lincecum than
Bubbles. I'd rather it be just someone else, because it's gotten to the point where it just hurts every single time Clay does that. It's like it becomes more frustrating. Like, if it's someone new, it'd be like, well, maybe the next time,
How much do I mean, just looking at this year, next year conversation? I mean, and I think this will be important throughout the trade deadline and like throughout the season as the Red Sox look like they may be competing. How much team building for this year versus Dombrowski team building for the next three or four years needs to happen right now? Like when you look at decisions. At what point are you all in on things this year, even if it might be not as good a decision for next year? Are you there? Obviously, I don't think we're right there.
Give me an example of a decision like that needs to be made. Because there's no one that believes we are going to pursue Clay Buchholz in a free agent reason, right?
And maybe this is the reverse. What if James Shields were available for Buchholz right now?
Again, I'm flipping. I'm like, whatever. Let's try someone new.
But Shields is on the hook for a few more years with more dollars, right? So there, you're compromised. Maybe you think Shields is an upgrade this year, but then you're eating, money for two or three. These types of decisions, if marginal increase this year versus marginal decrease.
But I don't think that's something that they would do. They wouldn't take on a long-term contract of someone that's a risk, right? That you're not sure of what you're going to get. They wouldn't. Unless they said, okay, we'll take Buchholz and Sandoval. But that's so. No, you're not going to see. But they're going to go for a lot of things this year because Ortiz is retiring. That they'd like to, milk that as much as possible, want them to go out on top.
Yep.
So assuming that they're in it, they're going to make moves to make this team better for next year, even if it hurts a little bit into the future. But
that's a good question. At the trade deadline, you have an opportunity that for the organization is good for the next few years, but it doesn't necessarily improve you this year. Like, are you so far all in on this team? And we're so far away from that right now. Like, we've got a lot of games to play. But, should their mentality be win now or keep building a consistent winner? in years past, that decision was made by buying players. This year, it could be a little different. I don't know.
Intrigued. I mean, so no, I don't think they do that. I don't think they hurt. Like, it depends on what you're getting back in return.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm just being completely ridiculous here, but let's say Theo comes to you and says, you know, I want Moncato, and I'll give you Anthony Rizzo and someone else. Like, you know, like, I mean, you have to, yeah, you might do that, and you're giving up the future, but it would be like, not those people, but it would be a huge trade. I'm just thinking, like, because when you're asking me the question, I'm like, what would Theo do? Like, would Theo this year, the Cubs are just sick, right? Like,
yeah.
And he probably doesn't have to do anything, but.
But you know, if he has the opportunity at the like to marginally increase the team, that
right.
he will overpay to yeah. do it this year because they're in the window, right? And I guess that's where we get to the point is to
I don't know if we're in the window.
So for the Red Sox to marginally increase their team, you may have to overpay. Do you do that? And we don't know
core,
that yet.
Yeah, and the core of the Cubs is there for a long time,
yeah.
right?
Yep.
So. To give up some minor leagues to marginally improve this year, to go from – and we're not talking like – I mean, the Cubs are going to win 110 games or whatever it's going to be that they're going to end up winning. It's going to be sick. It's what's going to make them better into the playoffs. And I mean, the Red Sox, the same exact thing. What's going to make – so is it a right – you know, a lockdown left-handed reliever that can just shut down an inning? Is it another closer that can – shorten the game, you know, pitch the eighth for you and shorten the game. Those types of moves Theo would make. Those are the types of moves that the Red Sox I could see making if we're in it. We're not going to blow up. At least I don't think we're going to blow up the minor league system unless you're getting someone like a Sonny Gray back that can help you for many years besides
right.
this year.
Right. Then, yeah. Yep. And not to get too far off, but we got totally off track there on the awesome conversation. But I mean, I think this throughout this year, there's going to be questions: is this how good is this team? Is it good enough to do certain things? Like, when do you get the confidence to you know about what this team is? And we'll go back to the thought on the schedule: 13 out of 16 at home. They haven't been a great home team yet this year, but you have full expectations that the Red Sox will be a good home ball club. This is a chance to maybe continue this run, win another 8 out of 10, and now you start to put some distance between yourselves and the other teams in the AL East, maybe, you know, except for the Orioles, but you're definitely you establish yourself as a contender into the you know second 30 games of the season. And so we'll see if that happens. As long as we don't have many Ron Copeland called games, I think maybe we got a chance, Paul. And until then, this is episode number 6 of Down by the River. Thank you all for sticking with us on a dreary Saturday afternoon.